Well, we are moving on in this next part of our series, The Art of Neighboring. And as we've been talking about the last few weeks, Jesus commands us very clearly to love your neighbor as yourself. And so we've been talking for a couple weeks now on what does that look like to love our actual neighbors, the people who live closest to us, around us, across the street, next door. And so the question that we've been asking as we move through this series, we've been asking this question: how can we move from stranger to acquaintance to relationship with our neighbors? And many of us have had to admit in the last couple of weeks, we don't really know our neighbors, and we haven't had a lot of interaction with them other than, we just see them in passing. And so 2 weeks ago, I gave you this map, this diagram, and I kind of said, if we are going to love our neighbors well, then we should probably start by learning their names. And so we've been working on this diagram. We're filling in the 8 closest neighbors to us, however they're situated. We discussed how that takes a little bit of intentionality, doesn't it? And it's kind of awkward, and we've got to put ourselves out there a little bit. But oftentimes it is these little steps that can lead to something more significant. And so hopefully you've all been working the past 2 weeks on learning the names of your neighbors and writing them down on this paper. And then last week we looked at the life of Jesus and saw how one of the ways that he moved from stranger to acquaintance to relationship, one of the primary ways he did this with people was through the use of food, like sharing meals together and welcoming people in and accepting their invitations to parties and things. People included Jesus in as well. And so the challenge from last week was be bold with your invitations and your hospitality, that you would look for opportunities to invite your neighbors over, to share meals together, find ways to include them in your hobbies and your rhythms, and just invite them to be a part of your life with you. And so after last week, we are all kind of eyeing the July 4th weekend, right? And we're looking at that as a very natural opportunity coming up in less than a month or so, and it's a chance to practice this in a really natural, tangible way. And so we're challenging everyone here to consider hosting some kind of a cookout or event or block party. I mean, whatever you want to do, it can be one or two neighbors, it can be the whole street, but just a chance to have a cookout, have people over, and just practice this hospitality. As Paul commands us, practice hospitality. And so just another very tangible way we can love our neighbor as ourselves. Well, we are going to mix things up just a little bit this morning. I have asked a good friend of mine, Kelsey Timmerman, to share a little bit about his life and what he does for a living. And I think there's a whole lot that we can learn from him when it comes to loving our neighbor as ourselves. Kelsey and his wife, Annie, attend Commonway, and they've been around here for a while now. And I want to share just a little bit of his background before he comes up to share, because there are some things about Kelsey that you need to know that he probably wouldn't say about himself. And so I want to say it for him. And then But I want to tell you first how I met Kelsey. I kept running into people a couple years ago who, they kept saying, "Matt, you need to meet this guy, Kelsey Timmerman. He traveled, around the world, and he's written a book, just one at the time, about his travels and experiences and his family. He and his family live in Muncie, and you would really like this guy." And so after about 20 people told me this, we somehow connected through email, and we ended up setting up a time to meet up at a coffee shop on campus. And so the day came, and I'm heading over there. I remember it's mid-morning, and it's one of those days when, the clouds are, right here, and dark, It's obviously going to be a massive thunderstorm. You can feel it in the air. That was that moment. I'm pulling in the parking lot, and it just starts pouring down rain, like torrential downpour. And Kelsey, again, who I haven't met, calls me on my phone, and he says, "I was riding my bike there from where I live, and just started pouring down rain." He said, "So I'm actually standing in the house of a stranger." And I was like, "Huh?" And so it turns out Kelsey was riding his bike, all this rain comes, and he stops in a neighborhood under a random tree in some stranger's yard to get out of the rain. He had his computer with him in his bag. And this woman inside the house sees him standing out there, and she invites him in, gives him shelter from the storm. Bob Dylan. Anyway, Cliff would appreciate that. That was for Cliff. And I'm like, "What is going on?" And so I happened to be driving my father-in-law's truck at the time, and I said, "Well, tell me the address. I'll just come pick you up, pick your bike up, and we'll, carry on." And so he gives me the address. I drive over there, and I go in and to this house, and I meet Kelsey and this stranger. And the thing was, they were talking like this might as well have been Kelsey's long-lost aunt or something. I mean, they were talking like they had known each other for years, and I couldn't figure out what in the world was going on. Turns out she was actually in the middle of reading Kelsey's first book at the time, and so all I'm saying is it is a little bit unusual to be reading a book and then to have the author of that book show up in a thunderstorm unexpectedly under a tree in your front yard. And so she couldn't be more delighted to have Kelsey standing there soaking wet in her kitchen. So right away, I was like, I think I'm going to like this guy. And this is the kind of stuff that happens to Kelsey for some reason. So Kelsey is the author of Where Am I Wearing? A global tour to the countries, factories, and people that make our clothes. And his second book, Where Am I Eating? An adventure through the global food economy. His writing has appeared in publications such as The Christian Science Monitor, Condé Nast Portfolio. It's aired on NPR. Kelsey's also the co-founder of The Facing Project, which seeks to connect people through stories in order to strengthen community. And of course, we just came out of a series called Your Story Matters, which is like what The Facing Project does. He's had all kinds of fascinating experiences. He spent the night in a, Castle Dracula in Romania. He's played PlayStation in Kosovo. He's farmed on four continents. He taught an island village in Honduras to play baseball one time. And in a former life, he was a scuba instructor in Key West, Florida. I thought of Kelsey as I was planning this series. And we've been, of course, focusing on loving our neighbors, our actual neighbors. But we all also know that, according to Jesus, our neighbor includes anyone who's in need, which includes the person on the other side of the world that we'll probably never meet. Kelsey understands this perhaps better than anyone that I know, and I know I've learned so much from him. His life, his mission, is basically to help people like you and me realize we are way more connected to our global neighbors than we might think. That the people who grow our food and make our clothes, that they have names and families and dreams for their lives and for their kids. And so he's taught me a lot about that. Kelsey has very graciously agreed to share a little bit about his experience and then to help kind of offer some thoughts on how we can apply that to here, to loving our neighbors where we are. And so I'll come up at the end. We'll look at some verses of scripture that we'll land on and wrap things up. But would you join me? Let's put our hands together and let's give Kelsey Timmerman a very warm Commonway Church welcome.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm really honored to be here today and kind of humbled. So we've been coming to Commonway for about 6 months now, and just everything that happens up here on stage, from the music to the message to everything that happens up there with Commonway Kids. So just thanks for having me here today, Matt. I'm really excited. So kind of as Matt summed up a little bit, for the past decade, I've traveled around the world to meet the people who make some of the things that we take for granted, from food to clothing. And I've learned a lot from our global neighbors about being a local citizen, about being a neighbor in our own communities. So today I want to share some thoughts and some stories from those experiences. But you kind of need to know, to just kind of like sum it up, just one example. One time I went to Bangladesh because my underwear were made there. It's kind of a weird thing. You're walking around the streets of Bangladesh and someone stops you and you're like, "What brings you to my country?" Like, this is going to be awkward. Well, my underwear were made here, so I came, you know. It's kind of weird. So you go to Bangladesh because your underwear were made there, and you come back and you write a book about it. You are an author. You go to Bangladesh because your underwear were made there, come back and don't write a book about it. You are just some weird dude. So it didn't all start off like this. When I started writing and traveling, it all started with really anthropology in college. That's what I studied. That's what I majored in. And it's kind of embarrassing why I majored in anthropology. It's because archaeology is a subfield of anthropology. And I knew about archaeology. And I knew about one specific archaeologist who I really wanted to emulate throughout my career. And it just happened to be the one that everybody else knows. Indiana Jones. So I graduated with a degree in anthropology, and I quickly put that degree to use as a scuba diving instructor in Key West, Florida. And I would save up money, and I would go travel, save up money, and go blow it all traveling. I started to write about some of my stories, some of my experiences. I started to get published in various publications, and like before I knew it, I was making like tens of dollars a month as a writer. It was awesome. It was like the world's most expensive hobby. I loved it. I loved it. So I never knew much of an excuse to go anywhere, so I was looking for the next place to go and have adventures and explore places, and I had this t-shirt that had tattoo from Fantasy Island on it. I don't know if y'all remember that show. He's the plane to plane, that guy. Anyone know the actor's name? Hervé Villechaize. I think I heard someone say it. That's pretty amazing that you knew that. So bonus points. So I was like, what if I just went? It said, come with me to my tropical paradise. And thought, what if I just went wherever this shirt was made? Just like this really random act of travel. So I checked the tag, and it said made in Honduras. And I booked a plane ticket. I booked a plane ticket to Honduras and to have adventures, to go jungle exploring. I shared a dugout canoe. I was searching for the elusive American crocodile with a biologist who happened to reach into the water. It was like 1 a.m, picked up a fer-de-lance snake, which is like a deadly venomous snake, and nearly set it on my lap, right? But this is the kind of adventures I wanted to have, me and the world exploring it, Indiana Jones kind of stuff. Like I was the main character in all of these stories, exploring, having adventures. And then I thought, you know, that was a little too much adventure, actually. I almost getting killed by a snake. But what if I actually showed up at the factory where my shirt was made to meet the people who made it? So I put on my shirt, and I show up at the factory gate. And I'm like, hey, guard, you know, the shirt, it was made here. Now I'm here wearing it. Like, can I have a tour of your factory, mister? It's like this whole full circle kind of thing. And he looks at me and like, who are you and why are you here? All really good questions that I did not have an answer to. So I waited inside the factories for the workers to be let out. And there I met a guy by the name of Amilcar. And that's when things changed. That's when things changed. And all my travels and all these adventures I had been having, I was kind of a citizen of everywhere and of nowhere. It wasn't so much about listening to other people's stories as living my own. And there I was, face to face with a guy who potentially made my shirt. And every day, like right now, we're wearing clothes that come from somewhere around the world, and someone made that, who has a family and names and strengths and weaknesses, and you just like made this global connection for me. So I wanted to know more about Amilcar, so I stopped and I listened. Just for a little bit, though, because it's really awkward. It is really awkward to meet some stranger, to meet your neighbor, and really ask engaging questions and like, what do you want from me? Like, what? And like for me, it's like I'll meet people, and I'm like, you sound really interesting, and you made my underwear. Can I follow you around for like a week? And like, I'll be there when you wake up, and I'll be there when you go to sleep. Can I watch you sleep? No, I don't actually go that far, but it's kind of creepy. So I didn't ask Amilcar those questions I wanted to know the first time, but he kind of inspired me to go and ask those questions and meet those people. 6 years after I met Amilcar, I had all these met all these people, and I went back to Honduras. He lived in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, which still is the homicide capital of the world. Like, not exactly a vacation destination. So I went back there to find him, and all I had was a phone number and a notebook. So I had my translator, because my Spanish isn't so great, call up the phone number, and someone answered. I couldn't believe it. It's a woman's voice, and she's talking, and he's talking to her, and like she's not hanging up on him. Like, this is amazing. And I'm like, there's more they're talking. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, Amilcar, something happened to him. He's dead. Like, what is happening? He hangs up the phone. He looks at me. He's like, Kelsey, you are not going to believe this. I'm like, what? Amilcar? He's in California. It's like, that's a safer place to go, right? So years later, I tracked him down. But Amilcar's story, and I finally met him again and asked him all those questions and learned about his journey, which is this amazing journey from his travels from Honduras to the United States, now where he's supporting his family. But it started with him. It started I started to listen to people more after meeting him, asking better questions. So I'm going to share a couple stories about community. One of them, I was training to run the Indianapolis Mini Marathon, so 13.1 miles. Anyone ever run the Indy Mini before? Yeah, so I was training to run the Indianapolis Mini Marathon. And this assignment to Kenya came up. And I'm like, oh, all of that training down the tubes, right? I'm like, wait a second, Kenya, running. So I, as all great modern adventures begin, I went to Google and I started typing in Kenyan runners or whatever. And I found this one village in Kenya, Iten, Kenya, that has the highest population of world-class athletes in the world. It's just this amazing place at 8,000 feet where people, mainly Kenyans, go to run, to train, and that's where they live. So I thought, hey, I'm going to go there. So I did my assignment thing, and then I went to Iten, Kenya to organize my own half marathon. So I recruited some people. It's going to be this really big event because I recruited a whole two people. I got two people to run with me. Dorcas is in the middle, and that's Richard there on the left. And so we start off on the run, and they're going to outline like one loop for me that I need to run three times. So we're starting off near the road, and this is an amazing place. Like, you're walking around Kenya, and people are dressed normal, right? Then you get to Iten, Kenya, and everyone's wearing track outfits and tennis shoes, and just, you know, thousands of runners come here and train. This is where they live, and they're, like, literally running their families out of poverty. It's kind of this amazing, amazing place. So they're starting off, and I'm like, go your normal pace. I want to feel what that's like. So they take off running, and I'm like, that's not that bad. Like, I'm impressing myself right now. 8,000 feet, Kenyan runners right on their heels. And then about 15 seconds into the run, slight incline, I'm like, oh, stop, wait. So they would run ahead, and they wait, and I'd catch up, run ahead, and wait. And at one point in time, I'm like near them, and a runner runs by, and I randomly give them a high five. And they turn around like, do you know who that was? I'm like, I have no idea. And they're like, that's Mustafa, the Olympic champion of the steeplechase. And I'm like, wow, that's the first time I ever touched an Olympian before. Like, that's kind of a weird thing to keep track of, I realize. But hey, still my one and only, me and Mustafa, right? So then we go around the loop, and I'm like, just save yourselves. I know the way. Like, I'll do it. So I go off on the second loop. And I don't know, I took a wrong turn at the cow paddy or the mud hut or the cow moved. I'm not sure what happened, but I got really, really lost. And it started to get dark. It started to rain. And I'm thinking, are there lions at this altitude? I honestly do not know. So as I'm running, this is probably how I'm running, just probably moaning. And I pass this old farmer. He's wearing like this, you know, rubber boots, and he's carrying a heavy load on his back, like buckets hanging off this, you know, thing on his back. And he, I pass him, and I nod at him. And he nods at me, and I run by. And then about 20 seconds later, I hear this clump, 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 clump. This old farmer runs with me for like minutes. He runs, just keeps up, no problem. You know, he's like in his 80s, and I'm like, you know, 30 something, and he's just no problem. For minutes, and then he finally stops, and he's like, that way. And I think that old farmer saved my life. I eventually found my way back to where I needed to go. But a random high five that happened to find an Olympic champion was just as likely to find someone who was out there for the very first time, who was trying to run their family out of poverty because they've seen their neighbors do it. They've seen their neighbors go and win, you know, the New York City Marathon, Boston Marathon. When I was running the half marathon in Kenya, a Kenyan was winning the half marathon in Indianapolis. And they've seen them win hundreds of thousands of dollars and turn their miles and minutes into acres and cows and educations. And they came back and they gave back and inspired their neighbors. And I look at them and I'm like, wow, if I lived here and if I had that level of success, would I come back? So here's Evelyn, someone who was trying to, she was out there for the first time, one of the runners who'd seen, inspired by the other runners. So I met her, and she was trying to run. I stopped and listened to her story and her very simple house, and her family had pooled their money to support her and to pay for her food. And just amazing, the sense of community that was there. Also, when I was in Kenya, I visited Mathari Valley. It's a slum in Nairobi, Kenya. And it's one of the poorest places that I've ever been. And I ended up spending the night there with some brothers. So there on the right is Thomas. In the middle is Moses. And that's their cousin James on the left. And I spent the day like doing laundry by hand with them, sweeping out like the community bathroom. And I was like horrible at all of these jobs, of course. And they were teaching me like such simple things, right? And I just couldn't even do them. And we went and played soccer, and we were walking around that evening, and it was dark. And when it's dark, it's like pitch dark in the slums. And we stop at this one place, and Moses starts getting kind of, he's crying. And Thomas gets real quiet, and finally I'm like, hey, James, like what's happening here? And they said, well, they had a brother that was killed right here. And then we went back to where their tent shack is and where I stayed with them that evening. And then it came up in the conversation that in, I believe it was 2008, there was an election. And the people, the losing tribe of the election, the Luo, were upset. And they went into the slums, and they were going door to door in the slums, knock on the door. Then they would ask a question of the person who answered it. They would ask a question in their native tongue. And if they couldn't answer it, they killed the person, killed the family, burnt down their house. So Thomas and his family, they belonged to the Kikuyu. But Thomas spoke the Luo language as well. So he knew that. And he knew that he could help his family and his neighbors. So he gathered up all of his neighbors, the ones that lived around him, hid them in their simple tin shack. And when the knock came on the door, Thomas answered, used the right words. And death went to the next door neighbor who wasn't there because they were hiding with Thomas. A few years ago, we had a heavy rain. It was frozen ground, snow melting, got really warm. It was in March. And I was working late one night in my office, and I heard a waterfall. Like, that's kind of weird. I heard a waterfall, and I go downstairs, and there's water coming through our front door going into our ductwork. We ended up with 6 inches of water in our home. The storm drain on the street had backed up. And you know, there was feet of water out on the streets. And when I realized this, I ran outside and I spent all that evening, like into the morning, unclogging the drains. And there's like lightning, there's a thunderstorm going off, there's tornado sirens going off. And I'm out there all alone in my neighborhood cleaning out these drains. I'm like running through people's yards and I'm like, I don't know who lives there. I hope they don't shoot me, you know. And I wanted to knock on the door and like, help. I could use some help, like unclogging these drains so our neighborhood doesn't flood. But I was also kind of afraid of that as well. Then I think about the sheet that we got here. I don't know if it's called Neighbor Bingo, but that's what I've been calling it. Is it called Neighbor Bingo? Is that, it is now? Okay. So I think about the sheet, and then I think about, like, I don't know a lot of those neighbors. And I think about the runners of Kenya, who I met, who inspired their neighbors, who come back. I think about Thomas, who he gathered up all these people and hid them in his house and saved their lives. And it really makes me think of how kind of crummy of a local citizen I have been, how crummy of a neighbor I've been. So they've really inspired me to try to get more engaged. You know, as I've been to some of the poorest places on our planet, I see that while they often have a poverty of resources, they often have a wealth of community. And I look at my own life, I kind of see the opposite of that. Our lives, we kind of have a relative wealth of resources, but a poverty of community. And this is documented, right? There's a great book called written by Robert Putnam called Belonging Alone. Talks about if you look at all the hallmarks of community, they've declined over the past 50, 60 years by 25 to 50%. What we're doing right now, being in a church, way fewer people doing it. People voting, people getting newspapers, people belonging to groups. There are more people bowling, but more people bowling alone. That's where the title of the book comes from. So I looked at my own life, like, how can I make a difference, be a better part of a community, give back more? And I wanted to do it through storytelling. So I ended up co-founding a project called The Facing Project, which connects people through stories to strengthen communities. And it does that by matching up people who are writers with people who are facing a certain topic. So that can be, the very first project was poverty, can be homelessness, sexual violence, addiction, hunger. We've had up to 22 projects now. And then the writer meets with that individual face-to-face, gets to know them well enough that they can write their story as if they are them. Then a book is published and a community performance is held. And the stories are shared. The community tells its own story. So back when there was only a couple projects, we were looking to do a second project here in Muncie. And I wasn't sure like what topic we'd do. I co-founded with a guy named J.R. Jameson, and we were talking about, you know, what we should do, the next project should be. And then my wife took my son Griffin to his 15-month-old doctor appointment. And when you're in those, like, just those checkups, like, there's the checklist, right? Does he do this? Does he do this? Does he do that? And Annie's like, no, no, no. And the doctor looks at her, the pediatrician, and says, what do you know about autism? And Annie's like, nothing, not much. And he's like, well, you'll come to learn a lot about it. You can schedule an appointment to go to Riley. It'll take about 3 months to get in there. And then Annie left. She came home, told me the news. Now, we're so thankful for a pediatrician, because to have the concern of a child with having autism at 15 months, like, that is really, really young. So he did such a great service, and we got therapy like right away. But still, we felt so alone. Like, we didn't know anyone who had kids who were on the spectrum. And, oh, there's nothing you can do in Muncie. You have to go to Indianapolis. You know, and as we started to look at it, we started to see that there was this, like, a really rich community around autism in Muncie. There's a group called Interlock. It was a place you can get diagnosed. There's places you can receive therapy. There's places you can go and you can share your story. And someone can share theirs. And you can kind of think of a path forward. So as I was thinking about what project to do, I thought about Annie sitting in that doctor's office. Like, wouldn't it have been great if, when he said, what do you know about autism, if he handed Annie a book that had 17 stories of people who had been sitting right where she was, right where we were, saying, these people live in your own community. Here's the list of resources in the back. So that's what we created, the Facing Autism Project. And Annie shared her story. So she got matched with a Ball State professor named Beth Messner, and they met face-to-face, and Beth, you know, listened to Annie well enough to tell her story as if she were Annie, and the book came out, and they printed 3,000 copies. This was 2 years ago, and then they ran out almost just within, like, 6 months to a year. They just printed more. So these stories are spreading not just in Muncie but throughout the country. They're online. All the time, Annie gets an email. We'll get a Facebook message saying, I read your story. We have a son. We think he might be on the autism spectrum. What should we do next? And it's all because Annie was brave enough to share her story, and all because of Griffin, and all because someone was willing to listen to her story and then share it. And also get shared on the live performance as well. So really, I feel like the building block of community is stories. As we carry and share stories, that builds the connections. But there's no stories if we don't listen. So someone who listens to people all the time, and listen to their stories and ask way too many questions, I thought I would share a couple of things I've learned about listening. First off, setting matters. Face-to-face is always better than over the phone, right? When I wrote the first Facing Poverty story, I got matched up with my storyteller, and I told her, just take me a tour of Muncie. Show me, like, landmarks that mean something to you. So she directed me, gave me directions, and eventually we end up at the cemetery. I'm like, where are we? She's like, this is where my dad is buried, and he died at a very young age, and that really impacted her. And then she was sharing her story. I was working on a story about my family and about farming, and I had my father, we made arrangements to go to the family farm that had since sold. We went back to the farm, and he was like, this is the hay mow where I played basketball, and then we'd fall out into the cows there, and we'd have to get the ball, and then we'd have to wipe off the manure, and this is where we shoveled the manure, and it used to be a dirt floor, and every time we shoveled manure, it scraped off a layer, so the floor's like dug down deep until it got so deep that Grandpa was like, we probably should put some concrete down here so we don't keep digging down. We went to a barn that had feed recipes or formulas or whatever they're called, that my grandpa had written on the wall in pencil, still there in his handwriting. And so much came out of Dad's story. If I were to ask him on the back porch, Dad, tell me about growing up on the farm, that conversation maybe lasts 20 minutes. Our conversation lasted for hours. So setting really matters. Ask a question. That's really important, right? What's there to listen to if you don't ask a question? I had a piano teacher who told me, Kelsey, if you want people to like you, you need to listen to them. You need to listen to them and get them talking about themselves. So ask a question. The third one's maybe a little uncomfortable. You aren't interesting. And what I mean by that is, like, you should not be interesting to you. So to hear yourself talking all the time, you are not going to learn anything new. But you meet someone new, they have a lot of new things you can learn from them, a lot of lessons you can learn. So listen to them. To a T, everyone I meet doesn't think that they're interesting, doesn't think that they have a story to share, a story to tell. 3 years ago, I was in Costa Rica, and I met a guy who's a banana farmer who broke his hand when he's a young child and is missing a finger. So he does the work of two hands with one, the work of 10 fingers with four, and he won Worker of the Year 1 year. Really hard worker, supports 5 family members. He's an amazing guy who I met, and I played frisbee with his family, showed him play ultimate frisbee, and I ate with them, and just over the course of a week, I got to know him and his children. And I wrote about him in my book, Where Am I Eating? And he gave me his phone number to, when I got home to the United States, to call him. And I didn't call him for 3 years. I didn't call him. I was nervous because, like, he speaks Spanish. My Spanish is horrible. Like, I don't know how that's going to work. Will it cost him a lot of money to answer the phone call from the United States? And I don't know. So I didn't call him. 2 weeks ago, I was in Costa Rica. Drove to where he lives and just randomly showed up. And I'm thinking, I'm so nervous. Like, is he going to remember me? Is he going to be angry at me? So we track down where he works. And I'm just nervous. And there he is, like, super big smile. It's like, Kelsey, like, he remembered me. And I think the reason that he remembered me, because I listened to him. There's so many of us that go through life, so many people in our lives that do not feel heard. And as a banana worker in Costa Rica, who's never been more than 20 miles from his home, he feels like he had never been heard. And he said that he had just celebrated his 44th birthday, and I gave him a copy of the book, and he's like, this is the best birthday gift ever. And I don't feel like, oh, I'm such a great guy. I listened to this guy's story. I told a story, and I was really awkward. I don't know how I feel about it, but I know that I went there, and I listened. And that's where every story starts. That's how we build communities. So I'll leave you with one last question. Who could you be listening to? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kelsey. The people that Jesus encountered, they all had stories, didn't they? They had joys, and they had pains, and they had things that they were proud of, and they had things that maybe some of them were ashamed of. But throughout the Gospels, Jesus made time to really listen to people. I think one of the things that challenges me about Jesus when you read through the Gospels is that he was interruptible. You know what I mean? Like, he was willing to be inconvenienced in order to speak with someone, in order to listen to someone. Jesus seemed to honestly appreciate learning about people's concerns and their values and their spiritual condition, and he found ways to ask questions to get to the heart of that, to find out what was really important to people. After, one example, after resurrecting from the dead, Jesus appears to two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and they don't know that he's risen, and in the circumstance, they don't then recognize Jesus in the moment. So Jesus shows up and he asks them in Luke 24, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" "What things?" he asked. See, if you've just risen from the dead, like, you can pretty much do all the talking, right? And he asked questions. "Tell me more." James 1:19 says, "My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak." You know, it's often the easiest passages to understand that are the most difficult to actually live out. I have a pastor friend who, he's had this kind of spiritual mentor from a distance. He never met the guy, but kind of a hero figure in his life. And through a set of circumstances, he ended up getting to golf with like this hero of his. And he couldn't believe he was getting this opportunity. He was so excited. And on top of that, he found out that they were going to be riding in the same cart together. And so here he was, 4 hours to spend with this guy. And he goes out and they golf the whole day. And my friend said, "You know what? He didn't ask me a single question. Not one, in 4 hours. And he basically, at the end of talking only about himself, he said, "You know, enough about me, let's hear what you think of me." He didn't say that, but that's the kind of the tone. And he said, "You know what, my friend said, I got done golfing after 4 hours, and he didn't know if I was married, if I had a family, what I did for a living, not a single detail about my life." And needless to say, that experience changed my friend's perception of this person he had really looked up to. What I love about Kelsey's story and what he's learned about listening to people is that you don't have to go to the other side of the world to do this. In fact, Kelsey and I were talking this week about how in some ways it's easier to do that. It's easier to go to some new exciting culture, particularly cultures that are, you know, hospitable and welcoming and people are eager to open up and share their story. It's easier there. What's oftentimes much more difficult to walk across the street. Because in our culture, that's more closed, and we're more guarded, and we're busier, and that just doesn't happen very often. So it takes courage to do this. It takes intentionality to listen. 2 weeks ago, after church, I was talking with a couple who was visiting here from out of state, and they're friends with someone here, and that was the week I talked about learning your neighbor's names, and they told me that they had just spent several years as missionaries to a remote tribal group in Indonesia. And they said, "We've been back here in the States for about a year now, and as you were talking, it's funny because in Indonesia, we knew all of our neighbors' names, and we knew about their families and what they loved to do and their, you know, all these things, there's details, because we were sharing life together." As Kelsey said, they lived in a place that was, you know, poor in resources but rich in community. And they said, "Since being back in the States, we've really struggled, and we felt isolated, and we don't know... It just doesn't happen because everybody just goes in their garage and there's no interaction. And so people don't even seem to be interested in relationship and getting to know each other." Paul writes in his letter to the Philippian believers, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interest of others." And so as we move along in this series, I get that we all lead busy lives. We've got work to do and projects that we're procrastinating and kids to shuttle around and errands to run and all these things. This idea of being interested, looking to the interest of others, doesn't happen by itself. By default, that's the first thing that gets pushed out. And so when Paul says the interest of others, he doesn't mean necessarily just what do they like to do on the weekends, right? This is something deeper. This is what motivates them. What do they dream about? What are their passions? What do they think the point of life is? What do they think about God? And so these deeper questions, these deeper meanings. And so all I'm saying is we can't look to the interests of others if we don't know what those interests are. And we'll never know what they are unless we stop and we ask questions and we listen and we take time and we're willing to be interrupted and we're willing to be inconvenienced. Would you stand with me? We'll pray. Heavenly Father, again, we think about the fact that you have placed us where we are for a reason. that there are people who live all around us, beside us, and across the street. And you've put us where we are to represent Jesus in that place. And so, Father, help us as we continue to take steps to introduce ourselves, to practice hospitality. Help us in all of that to listen well, to ask questions, to engage people, to demonstrate that that we really believe these people have value, have something to offer, and that we're interested in knowing and loving that person. So just give us the courage, give us the words, and more than anything, help us to be just intentional in our willingness to stop and to listen. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, thank you so much for being here this morning, for worshiping with us. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week as we wrap up this series.